Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, is made possible in part by the Department of State, Division of Historical Resources, and the State of Florida. It's also made possible by the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund and by the historic Rossiter House Museum and Gardens in O'Galley, celebrating pioneer history, the natural environment, and women's history. Available for weddings and events at rossiterhousemuseum.org. This is Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, online at myfloridahistory.org. I'm Ben Brotmarkle, and coming up on the program, we'll visit the Fall Jamboree at the Barberville Pioneer Settlement.
All of the demonstrators here, the musicians, the storytellers, the volunteers that make pull an event like this together and make it happen, we're all interested in sharing what we consider actual history.
We'll discuss Apalachicola Seminole boys attending a federally funded school in the 1830s.
The Choctaw Academy, an intertribal school supported by the education funds of Choctaw, Creek, Potawatomi, Miami, and Quapaw tribes, was located on land owned by Richard M. Johnson.
And we'll talk about the Florida Supreme Court cases involving Virgil Hawkins. All that ahead on Florida Frontiers. Bluesman Barry Brogan was one of dozens of musicians performing at the Barberville Pioneer Settlement Fall Jamboree, held annually during the first weekend in November. Located in West Volusia County, the Pioneer Settlement is the home of the 1919 Barberville School, which is surrounded by structures from the late 1800s and early 1900s that have been brought here to be preserved. They include a train depot, a turpentine still, a post office, a church, a barn, and cracker houses. The Barberville Fall Jamboree includes music, arts and crafts, demonstrations, and storytellers. Charles T. Langrick, known professionally as Charlie Cracker, is the event coordinator at the Barberville Pioneer Settlement and says that storytelling is an important tool for preserving Florida's cracker culture.
Storytelling dates back to before written language. The early humans were sharing stories and sharing history throughout time via storytelling, passed down from one generation to the next. In fact, if you look at some of the early biblical or more religious books, they were all word of mouth, storytelling, before they were written down into the form that we recognize them today. And that's true with Florida history. A lot of the stories that I know and that we share as storytellers here were passed down from one generation to the next. So I like to talk about my grandparents and my great-grandparents who came to Florida way back in the early 1800s and have been in this area ever since. So it gives us an idea of the real Florida, so to speak, in that they lived it at a time when it was not quite so comfortable as it is today.
In a time when Florida pioneers had no radio or television, not to mention air conditioning, storytelling and stories set to folk music were primary sources of entertainment. Storytelling and music are prominently featured at the Barberville Fall Jamboree, along with demonstrations of weaving, quilt making, blacksmithing, and other pioneer skills. Storyteller and musician Charlie Cracker has been known to do cooking demonstrations and is the self-proclaimed Hoe Cake King.
I started the cooking more or less accidentally as another demonstration of making musical instruments. I was making flutes and I used fire and burned holes in there, and nobody was interested in that for some strange reason. Until we stopped, my daughter and I, who was about six at the time, was with me, we stopped, and I decided to open a can of beans and cook up a few hoe cakes, which are basically just like a pancake, but made, they're savory, they're not sweet, they're made with cornmeal. And you cook them on a griddle or you cook them on a hoe, the head of a hoe. The reason they're called hoe cakes is because the early field hands would take the head of their hoe and put corn mush on them and fry them. And that's what they'd have for lunch or dinner or supper, instead of going all the way back to the cookhouse to have a meal. They'd cook it right there in the field at the time. So I cooked up a few hoe cakes and heated up a can of beans on the fire that I already had for my demonstration, and it drew a crowd. Immediately, people started to come see what we were doing. So from then on, I did hoe cakes.
Throughout the 1920s and into the 1930s, the production and sale of alcohol was illegal under prohibition. High demand for alcohol was satisfied by rum runners from Cuba and elsewhere, and some rural Florida pioneers turned to making moonshine. Charlie Cracker sometimes discusses how moonshine was made.
Okay, well, we don't say moonshine usually around here, not very loud anyway, because there could be law enforcement nearby, and it is illegal in the state of Florida to make moonshine, to make hard liquor. You can make beer and you can make wine a certain amount, but you cannot make hard liquor in Florida legally. So let's try not to say the word moonshine too much. We like to call it low bush lightning. Well, because moonshine was originally called moonshine because in the hill country, the Appalachians and those regions, they would move their stills at night so that they wouldn't get caught by the revenuers, who were the treasury agents, the law enforcement, who wanted to come and bust up the still. And they would do it when the moon was full so they didn't have to have lanterns, because you can see a lantern for miles away up on a hill, up on a mountain. And so they did it during the moonshine. And that's why it got the term. Those are the moonshiners moving around up there with their stills, moving them to a different location to keep the revenuers from finding them and to keep the competition from finding them. So we don't have that many big hills in Florida. This is pretty flat. But we do have a lot of bushes and a lot of palmettos, and so we call it low bush lightning down here. And I started that here at the Barberville Pioneer Settlement because, well, they have a moonshine still here. We also have one of, if not the only, freestanding turpentine still. So that's a distillation is a very important part of Florida history, turpentining specifically. One of the reasons the Spanish were even here was because of the naval stores in the area, and it's just grown exponentially since then. So that's distillation, just exactly like the same type of apparatus that you use to make alcohol with, moonshine or low bush lightning, as the case may be. And so that was my introduction into actually doing the moonshining, was starting out telling people about distillation and turpentining.
The unique pioneer settlement in Barberville and events like the annual Fall Jamboree help to preserve Florida's cracker culture.
And that's the reason that we do this. All of the demonstrators here, the musicians, the storytellers, the volunteers that make pull an event like this together and make it happen, we're all interested in sharing what we consider actual history. The history that we grew up with as children, or the history that you don't normally see in the history books today, and stuff that we've experienced in our lives and that our ancestors shared with us growing up, because in the end, that's all storytelling really is sharing that information with the next generation so that we can keep this information alive.
Charlie Cracker has participated in preserving Florida history at the Barberville Pioneer Settlement since its inception.
I came here when it was not even the Pioneer Settlement. It used to be a storage facility for the Volusia County school system. The big schoolhouse was a storage facility over there. And then several people in the area who were involved in the history and arts communities got together and decided to start the Barberville Pioneer Settlement at that time, which was called the Barberville Pioneer Settlement for the Creative Arts. And that was their goal, was to share the early arts of this part of Florida and the Deep South with future generations. And so I was in high school at that time, 1976, when they started all of that. And my art teacher was Dorothy Johnson. She was one of the originators of that group and brought her art class up here to help clean up. So I've been involved with the Barberville Pioneer Settlement since 1970s, but professionally doing events like this since about 88.
Charles T. Langrick, known professionally as Charlie Cracker, is the event coordinator at the Barberville Pioneer Settlement in West Volusia County. This is Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society. I'm Ben Brotmarkle. Visit us anytime at myfloridahistory.org to find great books on Florida history and culture, watch our public television series Florida Frontiers, and much more. That's myfloridahistory.org. Thank you. Joining us now is Connie Lester, Associate Professor of History at the University of Central Florida, Director of the Riches Digital Archiving Project, and Editor of the Florida Historical Quarterly. Connie, popular books and movies have made the American public more aware of the injustices against indigenous culture perpetuated in the schools established for Native American children in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, but such schools existed much earlier.
Indeed they did, and 8 Apalachicola Seminole boys attended one such school from 1830 to 1833. The Choctaw Academy, an intertribal school supported by the education funds of Choctaw, Creek, Potawatomi, Miami, and Quapaw tribes, was located on land owned by Richard M. Johnson, whose political career included terms in the U.S. House of Representatives, the U.S. Senate, and as vice president to President Martin Van Buren. The school was located at Blue Spring Farm in Scott County, Kentucky, where Johnson lived with his common-law enslaved wife, 2 children, and his enslaved farm workers. Ella Wells Drake argues in an article titled A Choctaw Academy Education that the school reflected conflicting goals and interests. The federal government advanced an idea that the school would transform hunter-warriors into model farmer citizens and, in the process, reduce Indian land claims through tribal land cessions. Tribal leaders who sent their sons to be educated at the school expected them to acquire skills in English grammar, spelling, writing, and reading, as well as basic and advanced math skills to assist the tribe in sustaining political and economic autonomy. Richard Johnson coveted the lucrative tribal funds designated for the schools and used his political offices and the support of the Choctaw agent William Ward, who was also his brother-in-law, to acquire the school. In the end, no one got what they wanted. The federal government did not realize the transformation they sought. Tribal leaders did not acquire well-educated sons who could protect the future of indigenous people. And Johnson saw the removal of support for the academy. The events that set in motion the enrollment of the Apalachicola Seminole boys in a school hundreds of miles from their home began with the friendship of Johnson and President Andrew Jackson. At Johnson's request, Jackson pressured Florida Territorial Governor William P. Duval to encourage the Seminoles to send their sons to the academy using funds created by the Treaty of Camp Moultrie. The Peninsular Seminoles were uninterested, but the Apalachicola Seminoles decided to send 8 boys to the school. Accompanied on their journey by Indian subagent David M. Sheffield and an enslaved man, the boys made the long journey to Kentucky, arriving at the school on Christmas Day, 1830.
It's hard to imagine what the boys must have thought as they traveled through 3 states to arrive in north-central Kentucky in early winter. Do we know much about conditions at the school?
Drake's extensive footnotes demonstrate a significant amount of primary source material available on the school. Quarterly reports were filed with the Office of Indian Affairs. There were letters between school faculty and government agents and interested civilians. Reports were glowing in praise for the progress being made at the school. But with hindsight, we can see that the academy never lived up to the claims. The various Indian funds were charged $200 per year per student for tuition, board, lodging, clothing, and medical care, plus a $10 fee for house rent and a $10 fee for teacher compensation. The tribes did not receive full value for their money. Upon arrival, the boys received new English names. They were placed in log cabins according to age and provided with a cot and a blanket. Clothing was distributed twice a year, and observers described the boys as ragged and dirty. They were fed in a dining hall twice a day in winter and 3 times a day in summer, 2 small meals and 1 more substantial meal. The food was prepared and served by slaves from the Johnson farm. Thomas Henderson supervised the school, which included a daily round of lessons, memorization, and recitation. Students were divided between 4 classrooms according to their learning level, with first-level students learning the alphabet and the basic elements of education. second-level students studying spelling, reading, and writing, third-level spelling, reading, writing, arithmetic, grammar, and geography, and fourth-level more advanced math and writing skills. With no prior education experience and with multiple native languages spoken by the students, progress was very slow. For the school, however, the weekly lectures on, quote, the necessity of industry, frugality, economy, piety, and religion, as well as honesty and integrity of character, end quote, were the most important lessons. The boys did not use books, but were drilled in their lessons by monitors, former students, using what Drake calls flashcards. They learned to recite the right answers, but were not truly educated. In 1832, Henderson, citing the slow progress of many students, asked for funding to construct shops to teach manual skills to boys unable to advance in the regular learning regimen. The student apprentices turned out shoes, boots, wagons, carts, and plows, which were sold in local stores connected to Johnson. In addition to their regular curriculum, their education included character building and promoted 19th-century Anglo-American values. They learned etiquette, engaged in debates, joined singing societies, and practiced self-government. On Sundays, they received religious instruction at either the local Baptist or the Methodist church. Reading between the line, one sees that the school was not as well-regulated as reports suggested. Boys refused to attend classes, fought with one another and with slaves and teachers. Some ran away. They stole whiskey and got drunk, invaded Johnson's house, and pursued enslaved girls for sex. Johnson moved his school 2 miles from his house.
Connie, the situation was clearly unlikely to produce the desired results. Did Seminole parents get wind of the situation and remove their sons?
As Drake explains, the Apalachicola's school experience moved in a seemingly predictable cycle until June 1833, when a cholera epidemic broke out in the area. As the disease spread from Cincinnati to other nearby towns, Johnson removed 60 of the 129 boys at the school, but panic and the presence of disease prevented full evacuation. Within 3 weeks, the death toll had reached 24, 14 enslaved people, one white man, and 9 students, including 2 Seminoles. As Drake explains, when news of the sickness and deaths at the school reached the Apalachicola towns, John Blunt, the father of one of the boys, took immediate action. Preparing to move west under the provisions of the Indian Removal Act, Blunt had requested that his son and any other boys from Davystown return to join their families in the migration. Having received no response, he feared the worst. Recognizing the loss of income, Johnson opposed the return of the boys, but more importantly, he admitted that he could not identify Blunt's son or the students from Davystown, and suggested that Florida officials send someone up to identify them. The changes of names at the start of their school career, the lack of interest in them as individuals, the poor result of the supposed education, and the miscommunication regarding the terms father and chief rendered the boys unidentifiable. Under pressure by Indian Affairs officials, Johnson conducted a more thorough interrogation of the Apalachicola boys and concluded that William Ficklin, one of the dead boys, was Blunt's son. Still not entirely convinced of the identity of the boy, he traveled to Washington, D.C. with one of the boys, George W. Hoard, who was questioned more thoroughly by the War Department. There it was determined that Ficklin was Hoard's brother. The other dead boy was an orphan. Blunt's son, Charles Phillips, was still at the academy. In mid-January, Florida sent an agent to retrieve all the boys. Once the boys returned home, a thorough reassessment of the Choctaw Academy occurred. The Choctaws attempted to reclaim their education annuity. The Creeks notified the president, quote, that they did not want their children to be taught how to work at the school, that they could teach them to work themselves, end quote. The Cherokees sought to withdraw their boys from the school. As one Choctaw leader wrote, quote, "Originally intended to improve and better our condition, the school has done comparatively so little good. The students returned with all the vicious habits of the lower order of whites, having lost the originality of the real Indian character. The federal government dismissed the complaints as evidence of Indian inadequacies."
Clearly, the Native Americans were much better off in their own educational systems. Thanks, Connie.
You're welcome.
Connie Lester is Associate Professor of History at the University of Central Florida, Director of the Riches Digital Archiving Project, and Editor of the Florida Historical Quarterly. This is Florida Frontiers. Virgil Hawkins led a valiant fight to become an attorney in Florida, with his case eventually making it to the U.S. Supreme Court. Sebastian Garcia has more.
Mary E. Adkins is a professor emeritus at the University of Florida Levin College of Law. She's the author of Making Modern Florida, How the Spirit of Reform Shaped a New State Constitution, and the award-winning Chesterfield Smith, America's Lawyer, both published by the University Press of Florida in 2016 and 2020, respectively. I spoke with Mary about her keynote presentation at the 2024 FHS Public History Forum titled Florida Constitutional Law, Cases in Context. She specifically focused on a trio of mid-century Florida Supreme Court cases that dealt with a Black man's admittance into UF's law school.
Virgil Hawkins was a Black man living in the Jim Crow South, and in 1949, the NAACP coordinated five test cases, five different people to apply to five different parts of the University of Florida. All were Black prospective students to see if Florida would admit them. Florida at the time was an all-white university. So the Florida Supreme Court said, no, you can't do that. And so four out of the five just gave up, and Virgil Hawkins continued his fight.
Justice Harold Sebring wrote the first of three opinions regarding the Virgil Hawkins cases. In addition to exploring the larger historical context, Mary also examined the backgrounds of each justice who penned an opinion to further explain the complicated and even contradictory tenor of the Virgil Hawkins cases.
That opinion was remarkable for its frankness. This was the one written by Justice Harold Sebring. Here's what he said. Virgil D. Hawkins is a Negro citizen and resident of the state of Florida. Get this. He possesses all the scholastic, moral, and other qualifications except as to race and color prescribed by the laws of Florida and the rules and regulations of the State Board of Control for admission to the University of Florida College of Law. So they admit right up front, there's nothing wrong with this guy except his, quote, race and color. And then they go on ahead to say, you know, this is a white school, he's a Black man, we can't let him in. What was remarkable about that opinion coming from that justice, Justice Sebring was one of those whiz kids. He actually was the head UF football coach while he was still a law student. He was a World War I veteran, decorated. But when he wrote this opinion, he had been back for less than 2 years from serving as one of the judges in the Nuremberg trials, trying Nazis. The trials that he was involved in were the medical experimentation trials. So he sees what race prejudice can do to human beings. And then he comes back stateside and he says, nevertheless, we've got to keep this guy out of our white school.
The Florida Supreme Court ultimately entered a final judgment roughly a year later, enabling Hawkins to appeal the case to the U.S. Supreme Court. The U.S. Supreme Court sat on the case until 1 week after the landmark 1954 Brown versus Board of Education ruling, resulting in a second round of the Virgil Hawkins case.
The U.S. Supreme Court sends it back to the Florida Supreme Court and says, please reconsider. Florida Supreme Court sits on it again for more than another year, so that by the time they're deciding it, Brown versus Board of Education 2 had been decided. That was the infamous one that said, oh, it might be hard to implement in the South, but we just ask that these courts integrate the schools with all deliberate speed. So Florida Supreme Court says, okay, great, we don't have to hurry. They, in fact, even said, and this was a different justice, he actually said that admitting Virgil Hawkins would cause serious public mischief. So this justice, B.K. Roberts, wrote this second opinion and concurring opinion by a justice named Glenn Terrell, who was ultimately the longest serving justice ever in Florida. He did not have a background that would make him sympathetic to a Black applicant. When you look at his papers at FSU Library, there's a stack a foot high of racist pamphlets.
Just as Glenn Taylor wrote another concurring opinion in the third and final Virgil Hawkins case, which explicitly highlighted the overall theme of Mary's presentation and current research more broadly, how history intersects with law, particularly how the former informs the latter, and how justices often impose the former to legitimize certain, usually problematic, opinions.
There was a final opinion in the Virgil Hawkins case that was wishy-washy, but it kind of admitted that, yes, he had to be allowed to go to law school. This time, Terrell again concurs. Here's what he has this time. Talking about segregation, he says, the Egyptians practiced it on the Israelites. The Greeks did likewise for the barbarians. The Romans segregated the Syrians. The Chinese segregated all foreigners. Segregation is said to have produced the caste system in India, and Hitler practiced it in his Germany. But no one ever discovered that it was in violation of due process until recently. I don't know what to say about that. But there ultimately was not justice for Virgil Hawkins. They finally agreed that UF would desegregate its law school on the condition that Virgil Hawkins not go there. So he ultimately went to a different law school. The reason I wanted to talk about this case and these justices is really kind of to make a point about the use of history in law and law in history. A lot of courts these days are using history, and I would suggest maybe cherry picking it a bit to try to find the original intent of whatever law or constitutional provision that there is. And, you know, maybe that's okay as far as it goes, but lawyers aren't trained in history. I'm both. I'm a lawyer, but when I started writing history, I went to school and I learned how to research history and how to think like a historian as well as like a lawyer. And so looking into this curious case of Virgil Hawkins, where you have some justices who had reason to rule differently than they did, they didn't. They ruled against him. They continued to rule against him.
For Florida Frontiers, I'm Sebastian Garcia, a graduate history student, FHS media production assistant, and history podcaster at the University of Central Florida, Department of History.
You've been listening to Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society. Please join us right here again next week. Until then, visit us anytime at myfloridahistory.org. Production assistance for Florida Frontiers comes from Connie Lester and Sebastian Garcia. The program is edited by Giselle Concepcion. Have a great week. I'm Ben Brotmarkle. Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, is made possible in part by the Department of State Division of Historical Resources and the State of Florida. It's also made possible by the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund and by the historic Rossiter House Museum and Gardens in O'Galley, celebrating pioneer history, the natural environment, and women's history. Available for weddings and events at rossiterhousemuseum.org.